This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by PureFlix's Samson, the biblical story of the last of the Hebrew judges. Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. Samson, in theaters February 16th. More information is available at samson.movie.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. We often lament the culture of death when it comes to abortion on demand, and it's why Christians have fought so hard and so long to try to stop the scourge of legalized child killing. But there is a growing threat, as we know, to those on the opposite end of the age scale, specifically those patients who want so-called death with dignity. Now, they might be terminally ill, or they just might not want to be a burden, but either way, there's a growing drumbeat of advocacy to help these people take their own lives under the banner of ultimate personal autonomy in the form of physician-assisted suicide or even euthanasia. And so this is another battle Christians must be roused to fight, and that's because we know that the Lord is the giver of life and our times are in His hands, and He is the same God who has told us, thou shalt not kill. So how do we make the solid biblical argument for life-giving alternatives to assisted suicide? We're going to talk about it today with Johnny Erickson Tata. Johnny is the founder and chief executive officer of Johnny and Friends International Disability Center. She is an international advocate for people with disabilities. And Johnny, of course, also recently marked her 50th year in a wheelchair after suffering quadriplegia after a diving accident. Today, we're going to be talking about her newly updated book. It's called When Is It Right to Die? And it's just great to welcome you back, Johnny. How are you?
Oh, Janet, good to speak with you. And thanks for having me on regarding this important topic.
Oh, thank you for being with us. I know when you wrote this book initially, things were not as bad as they are now. What are your reflections, thinking back to the initial release of the book and how it was much better back then, even though it wasn't so great back then?
Well, back in the early 1990s, which is when I wrote the book, there were no assisted suicide laws in any state. In fact, the whole idea of taking your own life or taking a loved one's life was rather abhorrent. We had a public consensus that this was an immoral act. But when the Supreme Court in 1997 ruled that there was no inherent right to die in the U.S. Constitution, it did not stop individual states from creating legislation based on people's perception of a right to die.
Right.
And so I knew back then that sooner or later, our entitlement culture was going to bring about this right to die issue before state assemblies and before public ballots. And so I wanted to update this book to give Christians a keen understanding of the arguments surrounding physician-assisted suicide, as well as to give people who follow Christ a language for articulating a biblical worldview on life, no matter how disabled, no matter how elderly, no matter how medically fragile your life might be. People are not better off dead than disabled. And I say that living 50 years in a wheelchair, dealing with chronic pain every day, and having battled stage 3 cancer.
Right.
Life is worth living.
That's right. Oh, man, there's so much packed into what you just said there. We have all these states now, obviously, that are on board with physician-assisted suicide. Ohio is currently going through the process right now. We already have California and Oregon and several others as well. What do you think is driving this? Is it a generalized culture of death mentality, or do you see this particular effort having a particular error to it that goes beyond the error of thinking you can kill a child in the womb? In other words, same worldview, but is this even worse?
Well, you're right. It is the same world. We live in an entitlement culture, as I said, which has largely been shaped by our radical sense of individual rights. When the Supreme Court ruled back in the early 1970s that the U.S. Constitution held within it an inherent right to privacy, that began this whole mantra of people dressing up their individual rights, trying to give them respectability by calling them rights. People dressed up their willful determinations, I should say,
yes.
And then began calling them as rights. Then we as a people became nothing more than a haranguing group of individuals fighting over who's more victimized than who. And now the exercise of rights has become a national competition where people are no longer interested in the common good, but we're interested in our willful determinations. And again, living in an entitlement society, people believe there is no virtue in suffering. Right. We feel we are entitled to healthy lives of ease and comfort and nothing less, and that affliction is to be avoided at all cost. And when you have people cultivating real fears about the future, fears about chronic pain, fears about aging, then we have translated these fears into social policy. Mm. And fear should never be the framework for a law. But yet, as you mentioned, we have six states, and now there are several others, Ohio, perhaps Delaware is soon to come after them, which are now translating these fears into euthanasia bills, this quote, so-called, quote, death with dignity. And people's fears, again, should never be the basis for social policy or for law.
Right. That's right. Well, I know you and I have talked previously about the fact that when you first had your accident, you were, of course, very depressed, really in despair at various points. And not just then, but I know throughout your life, you've had various very difficult times and very dark periods, as anybody can rightly understand. How do you speak, though, to somebody who says, well, Johnny, that's a choice for you, but my choice, like that woman in California you might have heard about who had Lou Gehrig's disease, and she threw a party for herself with her friends before she arranged to take her own life, which I thought was absolutely ghoulish. How do you bridge that gap, though, between a Christian who has a biblical worldview like you do and talking to somebody who has no concept of the Lord, no concept of his word, and trying to communicate to that person, I understand your fear and your suffering, but let me tell you why you should stay alive. What would you say to someone like that?
Well, first, I would encourage them to examine what that fear really is, because it might be a fear of pain. And if it's a fear of intractable pain, if that's the issue, well, something can be done about that, rather than killing oneself.
Right.
There are good pain management techniques. Let's surround people with spiritual community and improved hospice care. If people's fear is abandonment, if they're afraid of being left alone, well, let's concentrate on community. Let's improve community social support systems. Let's help lift people out of social isolation. If depression is people's biggest fear, and as we look at the statistics coming out of the state of Oregon, the reasons why people list why they opted for physician-assisted suicide is fear of pain and fear of depression.
Right.
Well, clinical depression can't be dealt with. You don't need to have a solution that is so final and so fatal as killing oneself.
Right.
There are answers other than the ultimate answer.
That's right. What about the person who would say, though, I just don't want to live, Johnny. I don't want to be a burden to people. I don't want to prolong this life. This is no way to live. You hear that sometimes from people who are severely disabled or have terminal illnesses. This is no way to live. You have great experience in this area. What would you say to that person?
Well, I would say that God agrees with them. God never designed us to suffer alone.
Yeah.
It is an awful thing to suffer alone. It's why God developed spiritual community. It is the answers for people's alienation. I know that when I was first injured, I wanted to die. I felt so overwhelmed, Janet, on the prospect of having no use of my hands or my legs for the rest of my life, having somebody do my toileting routines, give me a bed bath, somebody having to feed me, somebody put me in a wheelchair and then pushing me around all day long, somebody dressing me. The ideas, all of this was abhorrent to me. But I am so grateful for the friends who gather around me, and these were the ones who kept me connected to reality.
Right.
They lifted me up out of social isolation. They helped me get past the despair. They treated me not like a problem, but their friend, a person who desperately needed help. It is amazing the difference people feel about their life circumstances, even though they may be very depressing and very discouraging. It is amazing the difference that occurs when friends come into one's life and connect them to reality. So I would say, if there's someone that you know in your neighborhood, who is struggling with this, be their friend. My goodness, we are Christians, and relationship is the very basis for giving the gospel of Christ. What a practical way to show his love.
Oh, that's so well said. Johnny Erickson Tata with us. When is it right to die? We'll come back to this discussion on Janet Meffer Today right after this break. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to save babies' lives through ultrasound. Here's how a nurse describes the power of an ultrasound.
Last week, just one example of a mom who came in was very abortion-minded, and when she saw the picture of her baby on ultrasound and saw that beating heart, it was a defining moment that just broke her, and she said, I just can't allow this baby to be killed, for her own words.
By letting a mother hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time.
I cannot tell you how many times a baby's life is saved through ultrasound. It's just an incredible tool.
Will you help save babies' lives? For $140, you can sponsor free ultrasounds for 5 young women. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. Welcome back to Janet Meffer Today. It's wonderful to have you, and wonderful to have with us Johnny Erickson Tata. Her book, When Is It Right to Die? Newly updated. And what a great timely book to study and to share with a friend at these times when we are hearing all the time about assisted suicide, physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia. This is a matter of personal autonomy, many people say. I should be able to die with dignity if the situation dictates it. But in fact, we understand that the Lord is the giver of life and that he does have a purpose for us. Regardless of our suffering, there is purpose in suffering. And we're getting that biblical worldview today from Johnny. Johnny, when somebody brings up the money issue, this is something else that you hear in these euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide arguments. Well, it's just so expensive. I don't want to drain my family's finances in order to stay alive. I might as well hasten the process. That sounds so crass, but people really believe that if it's too expensive, I have a right and maybe even a duty to die.
Well, again, this is where I think the church needs to step in, because it is the church that doesn't put a price tag on compassion. It's the church that can surround that person with, as I said in an earlier segment, spiritual community. Yeah. to relieve the depression, to connect people to reality. It doesn't have to be an economic issue. There are support systems in a community, and the best one should be and must be the Church of Jesus Christ to reach out and provide that help and support. Now, it may be that that insurance runs out. Well, it should not be the option that the best medical care at that point then is a lethal prescription. Mm. No, let's start talking to our state assemblies. Let's campaign for those scarce health care dollars to make certain that they are spent wisely. I think talking into the health care reform debate right now, as Congress is looking at reforming Obamacare, let's make certain that Medicare and Medicaid are safeguarded. There are ways that we can, as Christians, speak into this process, not only on a local level, by being good friends to those who are despairing and connecting them with the God who loves them. But also we can speak into the debate on a national and a statewide level as well. State assemblies, these are the very things that people are debating right now. And I know in my own state, there are cutbacks and benefits and services to the elderly and the disabled, those who lack insurance. And we need to step up to the plate and make certain that our voice is heard in our own state assembly. So whether it's on a national, federal level, whether it's on a local, state level, or whether it's in our own neighborhood, among the people who are struggling to find where is this life worth living, and I really would rather be dead than disabled, we can give them that hope. We can give them that encouragement. And as I said again in an earlier segment, it is surprising how life-transforming a good, honest friendship can be.
Yeah.
I know it's true in my life, and I've seen it happen in the lives of other people with disabilities, the elderly, and the medically fragile. Just connecting with another person who cares and can show that compassion is not 3 grams of phenobarbital, but compassion is love and caring and support and perseverance and not abandonment, but being there, journeying with that person through their pain. That makes a huge difference.
Of course it does. You know, this gets back to what life is, who created life, why life matters, and why God said, thou shalt not kill. When we get back to the fundamental issue of whose life matters and whose doesn't, we seem to have this mentality in which people are separating out, if you're fully functional physically and mentally, then your life is good. But if you have any sort of problem physically or mentally, maybe your life doesn't matter as much. How do we biblically address that?
Well, I think that is the problem of living, again, in a culture of entitlement, where the utilitarian utopia is promulgated through our advertisements and through Madison Avenue, through our own conversations. We need to understand that a healthy civilization is best judged by the way it treats and respects its elderly, its poor, its uninsured, its handicapped persons, and we need to share that view over coffee at Starbucks, over the backyard fence of our neighborhoods. We need to share that view with our coworkers around the water cooler. And you mentioned yourself that it is all grounded in a biblical perspective on suffering. And in the book of Job, chapter 14, God says man's days are determined. You know, God has decreed the number of our months and has set limits that we cannot exceed. And to help people die before it is their time to die is not only fatal, it's terribly, horribly final.
Right.
So rather, let's choose life. Let's choose the resurrection of the life. Let's choose the Prince of Life. He is the way, the truth, and the life. Let's trust the Word of Life and choose the Bread of Life and introduce people to Christ, which ultimately is what they are most hungry for and thirsty for, not an early death. They want hope, and hope is to be found in the blessed hope, as the Bible calls him.
Oh, that's great. Johnny, can you speak a little bit to the issue of purpose? We seem to be very much obsessed, regardless of our own physical or mental capabilities, with the idea of what difference does my life make in the grand scheme of things? And can I crack God's code as to why I'm here and what the ultimate meaning of my life is? We tend to go down that road sometimes to our peril because we can't unlock fully the mind of God. So how do you deal with the issue of purpose and meaning when someone is depressed, perhaps in a disability situation, and saying, I don't even know why I'm here? Because clearly that's a human question. That's not just a...
Yes.
Yeah.
That's not just a human question. It's my question, Janet. I tell you, after 50 years of quadriplegia, there are so many, many mornings I wake up, and I have to preach the gospel to myself. I have to remind myself. I have to deal with myself, those heart issues that wrestle within me, because I find life so difficult at times. But then I remember the things that are true and not lose heart. I recall that outwardly I might be wasting away, yet inwardly I'm being renewed day by day as I trust the Lord. Mm. And I've got to remember my purpose, the purpose of us all, is to understand that our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So, Johnny, when you're depressed in the morning because you're a quadriplegic, fix your eyes, not on what is seen, but what is unseen. Mm. Because what is seen is temporary. Your body is temporary. But what is unseen is eternal. So I don't need to fear suffering. By my courageous response to it, I can achieve myself an eternal glory that far outweighs all my pain and discomfort. And I think that's what biblical purpose, Janet, really is all about.
Mm. You're right about that. Well, and you have such a heart to get the gospel to the disabled community, because clearly this is becoming more and more of a marginalized community in many ways as this mentality takes root. What do you say to the church about the need to reach out to the disabled who don't yet know Jesus Christ, to see the disabled community as an unreached people group in many ways?
Well, I would tell Christian leaders, actually anybody who's a Christ follower, look at the people Jesus hung out with.
Yeah.
Virtually on every page of the gospel, he's talking to somebody with a handicapping condition. He's hanging out with, you know, guys on straw mats, paralyzed by the pool of Siloam. He's talking to the blind, the deaf. It absolutely drove his disciples crazy. They were so outraged that he kept spending time with these, quote, nobodies. But I love the passage in Mark chapter 10 where Jesus and his disciples are leaving Jericho, and there's this blind man screaming by the side of the road, "Jesus, have mercy on me." And the disciples tell him to shut up. But then Jesus says to his disciples, he stops and he says, "You call him." And so suddenly they see that their Savior, their Lord, has this high life priority for this man who's blind. And so they rush over to him and they say, "Cheer up, the Master's calling you," which is so funny because just a couple of verses earlier it was "shut up," and now it's "cheer up."
Yeah.
And I think the reason the disciples did that is because they saw the high life priority that Christ placed on this blind man.
Yeah.
And they probably never looked at another disabled person the same way again.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lesson for us now in this century. We are to look at the way Christ loved the poor, reached out to the marginalized, the elderly. He had a heart for the widows, orphans. You know, pure religion is this: look out for those that nobody else is looking out for. And the disabled, people with disabilities, can be listed in that large people group. So let's look at the example of Christ, his life, and who he loved spending time with, and let's model that.
That's great. You know, when you mention the word mercy, it reminds me that another excuse people will offer for choosing physician-assisted suicide is, well, if we have a dog who's sick, or we have a pet, maybe a cat who's sick, out of mercy, we put that pet down. Why can't we just apply that to humans? We're just animals after all. What is the difference between that sort of quote-unquote mercy and the true mercy of Jesus Christ?
Well, it's a matter of definition, isn't it? Because, you know, mercy, I think, in the sense of putting down a dog, you pity that dog. That dog is helpless, and so you have pity for that dog. But if it's your grandmother, your grandmother's not a dog. Your grandmother is an image bearer of Almighty God.
Yes.
And so her body must be treated with great respect, because as it says in Romans chapter 14, none of us lives to himself alone and none of us dies to himself alone. In other words, we are not our own. We just cannot do with ourselves or with others as we so deem fit. Because we are image bearers of God, we have to look at what God says. And God says, choose life. And if there's a question, err on the side of life. And don't be mixing definitions when it comes to mercy and compassion. Compassion and mercy are not seven pads of fentanyl on your chest, which will take your life. No. Compassion is sitting by that person's bedside, holding their hand, praying with them, lifting them up out of social isolation, ascribing positive meaning to their pain, walking them out up and out of their discouragement. I mean, this is compassion. That's Christian compassion, and that's mercy.
Amen. Well said. Well, Johnny Erickson Tata's book, When Is It Right to Die, the updated edition. Wonderful book, and wonderful to talk to you again, Johnny. God bless you, and thank you so much.
You too, Janet.
All right. God bless. And we'll be back on Janet Mefford Today after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or visit preborn.com. This hour of Janet Meffer Today brought to you by Preborn. For your gift of $140, you can give an ultrasound to five women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY, 855-601-2229, or preborn.com. All right, I want to talk a little bit about this very disturbing story from the UK, and I often will turn to what's going on across the pond because it always seems to be something that eventually will be happening in the United States. Here's an example of the effect of Islam on Christian ministry. There's a pastor in South London by the name of Paul Song who has lost his position and has been banned from the Brixton prison in South London. Because in 2015, his boss became a man named Muhammad Yusuf Ahmed, a Muslim imam. An imam came in 2015 and, according to Mr. Song, pursued a discriminatory agenda and a campaign to end Christian domination of the prison and presumably the ministry of Christian chaplains. So what ends up happening? He said he was falsely accused of calling one inmate a terrorist. Apparently, this was an inmate whose name was never shared. And he says the real motivation behind his removal was to clamp down on Christian ministry in this prison in South London. Why is this such an important story? Well, don't you think that prison ministry is a critical part of Christian ministry? I do. The Bible talks about it. You visited me in prison. Jesus talks about that in the parable of the sheep and the goats. It's one of the ways that we know we are caring for those who are the least of these, and we are doing what we should do as Christians. We are to reach out to people in prison because they are in need of hearing the gospel like anybody else. And you think of all the prisoners who have come to know the Lord Jesus Christ. Chuck Colson, a perfect example of somebody who went on to have a big impact on prison ministry throughout the years, because he understood what it was like to be saved. So this is something that is non-negotiable. But this is going on in South London, and now this Christian chaplain is not allowed to do his ministry. Now, Andrea Williams is chief executive of a group called Christian Concern over in the UK, and she did an interview with a group called Premier describing what is going on in the prison and also something else that went on. And that was how Pastor Song had to stop distributing some evangelistic programs that had been distributed in the prison and helped out inmates to know more about Jesus Christ. Listen to cut one.
Interestingly, when the imam came in, Muhammad Yusuf Ahmed, he said that the materials, the Alpha Course, Just 10 by J. John, and also a course that Pastor Song did, that he had written, a blessing course, that these were too radical, that he should stop doing those courses within the prison. Now, I think we have to bear in mind that over 70 people were subscribing to these courses. They were, in fact, oversubscribed, and that Pastor Song had been in the prison for almost 20 years. At one point, along with 15 other chaplains or Christian volunteers that were going in during the week. And we've met at Christian Concern many ex-prisoners who've been absolutely delighted and had their lives transformed as a result of the work and the ministry and the witness of Pastor Song. But what we are now seeing in Brixton Prison is increasingly people being converted to Islam. We're seeing increasingly, according to Pastor Song, domination by Muslim gangs within the prison and a climate of fear. And sadly, now for some time, there has not been any appointed chaplain, official chaplain, in Brixton Prison.
Well, that's pretty scary. That's really scary. First of all, you've got an imam banning Christian literature and Christian evangelistic programs within the prison because he says they're too radical. A Muslim imam is declaring Christian evangelistic material too radical. I know, the irony is rich. Absolutely incredible. But you have this climate within the prison of many Muslim converts and Muslim gangs. And according to Andrea Williams, a climate in which these gangs rule. And there's a climate of fear. You got to get rid of the Christians. You got to get rid of this is England, folks. This is why it's so. This is not Iran. This is not Syria. This is not any Middle Eastern country like Afghanistan, where Islam is the dominant religion. This is England. And what sort of England can you envision in the future if this sort of thing is happening in the prisons right now? So then Andrea's asked, was Pastor Song actually breaking the rules? Here's cut two.
He was doing absolutely nothing. He's got a clean record, and indeed, there's a video that will be going out later today where we can see the person, the kind of person he is, the heart that he has. Indeed, when he comes to see us at the office in order to prepare this case for him, he usually has with him a friend that's often an ex-prisoner that he's working with. He's very serious about his work. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the way in which he was stopped from doing this course, well, in fact, first of all, he was stopped from doing the course, and this was before we had met him, and he just stopped doing the course. He was told that he could continue to come into the prison at that point.
Right.
So he came in and saw the prisoners one-on-one. But then the imam sent him an email, this is back in September, saying that a complaint had been made against him and that he was suspended from coming into the prison. This complaint was never substantiated. The name of the prisoner that the imam said had made the complaint was never given. And as a result of that, he was suspended and told he could not come back into Brixton prison.
Right.
Now, we then, Pastor Song then appealed that, and there was then just silence.
Well, that's interesting. So first he's told you can't bring in these evangelistic programs that 70 prisoners at least were benefiting from and growing in their faith in Jesus Christ from using. You can't use those anymore. So then he goes back after stopping the courses, and he's still going to the prison, and he's still doing one-on-one ministry. Then he gets this accusation by a Muslim inmate who's unidentified, saying that he called the inmate a terrorist, and then no more. He can't. Where is due process? Just because a Muslim inmate casts some sort of charge against him, it's automatically believed. He doesn't get to defend himself. He doesn't get to stand up for himself. And look at who's in charge, a Muslim imam who said, we've got to stop the Christian domination in the prisons. This is how you redo societies, by the way. This whole multiculturalism thing does not end well for Christians. It just does not. So then Andrea is asked, can other Christians take up the work that Pastor Song has left? Cut three.
It's very fascinating because we've got a number of witness statements from a number of volunteer Christian workers that are in there that talked about vibrant work over the many years. They have all left. So, and certainly there has not been an official Anglican chaplain. I believe that the Catholic chaplain still is there, and I believe that some prisoners go out on a Sunday. But during the week, there is no longer any Christian meetings going on in Britain, according to what we know, certainly right. At this time, certainly when Pastor Song was there.
Well, again, you have a climate of fear in the prison. You have a climate of fear in England. Let's face it, you have a climate of fear in London. You have a London mayor who's a Muslim. You have a climate of fear. You also had a number of Islamic attacks over the last several years. And then you're supposed to say, hey, well, you know, this is part and parcel of living in a big city. That's what Sadiq Khan said, the mayor of London. This is part of living in a big city. You just got to expect terrorist attacks from time to time. What is going on? What's going on is you have a once Christian nation that is handing over its culture. That's what's going on. And you might say, well, it's slow. You don't have Muslim dominance in England. You don't have a Muslim majority in England. And there are many people in England who are concerned about these things, who are raising objections about these things. Yes, but this is the same country that is constantly having public officials coming forward and saying that Islam is a religion of peace. This is the same country that has banned people like Robert Spencer and Pamela Geller here in the U.S. who tell the truth about Islamic jihad and banned them from coming into Great Britain because they're considered to be dangerous. They're not dangerous. They're warning you about the people who truly are dangerous. And as long as you have that sort of mentality in England, you will continue to be dominated. So this shouldn't be surprising, but it is certainly alarming. We're going to come back right after this. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us.
PureFlix comes Samson. The biblical story of the last of the Hebrew judges, from his anointing to betrayal to redemption.
My name is Samson, and you will face the wrath of God.
Samson, rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters February 16th. More information is available at samson.movie.
This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here's Stephanie's story.
I reached out and contacted Trinity, and I've been able to pay off close to $15,000 in the last 18 months. And I can't help but thank Trinity enough, because they taught me the ways to budget my money and gave me clear goals to have so that I could put myself into a better position. But I was able to stick with it, and it's worked beautifully. It's a godsend.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your account, put a stop to late fees, and drastically reduce your interest. There is hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. When a cake artist declines to create a custom cake for a same-sex wedding, he's forced to defend his decision in court. That's what happened to Jack Phillips, and the Supreme Court is now deciding his case. Your religious freedom is under serious attack, and that's why your gift to Alliance Defending Freedom is needed right now. Just $100 helps Alliance Defending Freedom provide the necessary resources to fight these pivotal court battles. Call 866-700-1060. That's 866-700-1060. We are back on Janet Mefford today. Thank you for joining us, telling you a little bit about this Christian chaplain over in the UK, South London, who lost his job in Brixton Prison, where he did ministry for 20 years. He had to get rid of the evangelistic programs he was using with the inmates because a Muslim imam, who now heads up that ministry oversight, I should say, wants to decrease the Christian domination of ministry on the premises. And so he had to get rid of those courses. And then eventually he was falsely accused by a Muslim inmate of calling him a terrorist, and he was out. He's done. The final decision to dismiss Mr. Song, Paul Song, this chaplain, was taken by the prison's management. So the management is backing up the imam. And now there could be some legal action involved. Andrea Williams was on a show in the UK talking about this. She is chief executive of Christian Concern. One more cut I want to play for you is the question of who has authority over all this? And what are the prison authorities, who are higher than this imam, having to say about it? This is cut 4.
Well, interestingly, Pastor Song will say that there's a sense in which Brixton Prison is becoming increasingly violent and lawless. And even some of the prison warders often look to the imam to try and keep control in there. Many demands are made, for instance, with regard to food and times for prayer and so on, according to Islam within the prison. So there's a sense of real tension. And I think we're hearing this across the prisons at the moment. And that's why it's absolutely vital that we begin to understand what's going on. Indeed, Ian Aikson, who conducted an independent review into what is going on in our prisons in this country at this time, is quoted in the Times newspaper yesterday as saying that it's vital that we ensure that Paul Song gets a fair and just hearing for his removal.
Right.
And I think when we think that the Alpha in Prisons, which was a great work that was going on, if we think just about how much that has been removed from many prisons, how that is not really going on, certainly in many of the London prisons anymore, according to my knowledge. That is devastating, because we know the thing that really changes and transforms the lives of prisoners is the love and the forgiveness that's found in Jesus Christ.
Well, that's right. So we'll keep up with this and keep you posted on what goes on with this particular legal case. But this is part and parcel of the bigger problem here. And we've been talking about it for quite a while, the replacement that is taking place in Europe. It's not just England. It's not just the UK. It's Europe. It's Western Europe. And Gatestone Institute recently did a piece on this. Europe, Judeo-Christian symbols vanish, Islam rises. Here's what they have to say. Look at the images taken by this Israeli-Hungarian photographer. Synagogues, like silent witnesses of the fall of a fundamental branch of the European civilization, have been turned into museums, swimming pools, shopping centers, police stations, and mosques. Now it is the turn of the Stars of David and skullcaps, the two most visible Jewish symbols. A poll by the World Zionist Organization recently revealed that at least half of Jews in Europe do not feel safe wearing symbols of their faith. They're right. A few days ago, an 8-year-old Jewish boy wearing a skullcap was attacked and beaten in the street by two men in Sarcelle. Earlier in January, in the same suburb, a man slashed the face of a 15-year-old Jewish girl who was walking home while wearing the uniform of her Jewish school. It is the new normal for French Jews. For years, European elites have been preaching multiculturalism and religious and cultural relativism. Now we find ourselves living through not only further assaults on the habitually besieged Jews and their faith, but a massive de-Christianization as well. A historic German church, St. Lambertus, was demolished last month. The 19th century Catholic site in Germany was destroyed to make way for a coal mine. It's sadly ironic that the only group protesting this shameful destruction was a secular non-Christian one, Greenpeace. 40 activists climbed the church to protest its demolition, and they displayed banners reading, "Those who destroy culture also destroy humans." Greenpeace. Where were the Christians? The abandonment of old churches is not an economic question. Last year, the German Catholic Church's revenues reached a record $7 billion. If it is rather a question of cultural decline, then that's what we're talking about. It's a fate also overtaking many other Christian sites in Europe. The British housing market is now dealing with a new special entry. Former Christian churches, a former Methodist church in Surrey, was recently put on sale for the first time in its 154-year history. And a few days later, a church in London went on the market, converted into apartments. Religious symbols are an integral part of a civilization. One French author says communism was a kind of false religion, although it had its own liturgy. A religion is much harder to destroy than a political system, and religion plays a key role in the society and in its cohesion. When old symbols vanish, new ones with their own identities take their place. One professor says Islam is a reaction to Christianity, which it wishes to replace. Islamism is an attempt to replace Judeo-Christian civilization. Europe's public imagination today is being flooded with Islamic symbols, from veils in schools, swimming pools, and workplaces to the volume and height of mosque minarets. Well, as one columnist over in the UK put it so well several years back, Britain, you will miss Christianity when it is gone. I hope it's never gone. And I don't believe it'll ever completely be gone, but you never know. You never know. And what is the Lord's purpose in all this? At what point will the UK shake itself out of its slumber and say, what are we doing? What are we doing? Everything that we've stood for. We're the land of the Magna Carta. What are we doing? Why are we allowing these people into our land to take over our civilization? What is going on? Why did we allow this to happen? And unfortunately, it will be subsequent generations who will be having to answer that question. Now, this is interesting. The BBC is out with a new report. Breitbart writes about this. A new report published by Bristol University studying data from the British Social Attitude Survey about attitudes to immigration among faith groups shows overwhelming opposition to the current high levels of immigration into the UK. This is unsurprising because the rapid mass uncontrolled immigration into Britain in recent times is unprecedented. More people have immigrated to the UK in the last 20 years than in the previous 900 years, going back to the Norman conquest, with over 5 million migrants net since 1997. These are just the people counted by the government's extremely poor and slapdash methods. It doesn't include those who have smuggled themselves in on the back of a lorry or on a dinghy in the middle of the night. The report shows 87% of Anglicans want immigration reduced compared to 77% of the population as a whole. But what caught the eye of the BBC, who put together a report on the findings, was that regular churchgoers across all Christian denominations were less inclined to want to reduce immigration. 66% of those attending weekly or more said they wanted to reduce immigration, which is a clear majority, but lower than the 81% of those who attend once a year. What's the reason? A likely reason, according to this author, is the arrival of Antonio Gramsci's long march through the institutions at the doors of the church. In the BBC's report, they wheeled out a couple of left-wing vicars to explain why mass migration was good. One of them runs an organization called Diverse Church, which concerns itself with leftist narratives of class, race, and gender, and agitates for the church to accept same-sex marriage. Its website links to the Institute of Race Relations, which includes articles on race and class, narratives that marginalize, etc., etc. The other, the Iranian-born Bishop of Loughborough, haughtily declared that congregations needed to be educated to accept mass migration. In my own experience, this writer says, the vicar of the church I used to go to recently began to use the pulpit to denounce Brexit and President Trump and to call for more migration and gender equality, even though we have gender equality in the UK and migration leads to exploitation of workers and unsustainable pressure on the National Health Service, school places, and the housing market. And this is sadly typical, he says, of many churches which have become mouthpieces of the liberal left. Well, what do you think is happening over here? You have all these evangelical leaders. Oh, we must have DACA. The same evangelical leaders who are joining forces with these refugee resettlement agencies that are federal government contractors. Bring in more Muslim refugees. Bring them in. Bring them in. It's part of our welcoming the stranger duty. You got to have DACA. That's part of our welcoming the stranger duty. It's all about being holistically pro-life. Folks, pay attention to this because this is so obvious to some of us and not obvious at all to many others that the church is a really good place to play the guilt card and to take the Bible and wield it as a weapon in an unbiblical way to fool those who don't understand what's at stake. You have churches in the UK, unfortunately, who are aiding and abetting the overturning of their own Christian civilization. That's what's going on. That's why we fight so hard here in the United States to say the best thing for Christian civilization is to maintain the wonderful republic that God has given us. It's all the time we have. From Pure Flix comes the biblical story of the last of the Hebrew judges, Samson. Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. Samson in theaters February 16th. More information is available at samson.movie. Thank you so much for being with us. God bless you. We'll see you next time here on Janet Mefford Today.